Warning. In this episode, the boys forget that they are indeed recording an engineering podcast. Therefore, the preload is over 20 minutes long. If you hate fun, you can skip to 26 minutes and 40 seconds. Viewer discretion is advised.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode. Everything is a spring. I'm here with Derek. I'm Jim. Derek, how are you?
Hey, Jim. I'm doing great this week. I'm really excited to get in the preload. Something happened.
Oh, boy. How was your week, buddy? My week was pretty good. It was kind of insane. It's basically like 2 weeks before Christmas, right? And, you know, Whiskey Grail, we're right now, like Whiskey Grail is, we're popping off the walls, right? Like we cannot keep up with orders. And we're just basically, as soon as a cup comes off the assembly line, it's sold. Like it's gone.
Instantly.
It like shipped the same day, basically, type stuff.
Jeez.
Because we're just trying to move as much as we can and catch the Christmas wave. So, so naturally on Friday of last week, right? About a week and a day ago, you know, we had a lot of duds. We had a lot of grails that failed QC for one reason or another. And I was like, that's weird. But I just assumed that it was like, okay, well, we're just trying to rush. And so we need to like slow down a little bit or whatever. So then Monday and Tuesday, it happened again. And so Tuesday I was like, all right, I'm getting to the bottom of this. Like, it's not just people being lazy at assembly or whatever. Like there is an actual problem. So my like Tuesday morning, right? Like I go to my work, I come back, I skip lunch. I immediately go to the shop and, you know, we just bust out this problem. We're like, what is it? And we figure it out. And it turned out that somebody had dropped one of the jigs for our table saws. And when that happened, it actually dinged one of the corners. So it had pushed it down. And it had pushed it down enough that it was no longer level with the table saw surface. And so that was throwing off our cups. And so we had a lot of duds. We had to throw out, you know, I think probably about, I think it was about 70 cups, 70 grails over Friday and Monday, which was tough, which sucks.
How do you even find out? How did you find the root cause? Did you just like end up looking at the table saw and it was immediately obvious or?
So there's a couple like, I guess like as you're doing this kind of stuff, you like at the assembly process, for example, like I'll just kind of go through this example in particular, right? We were having a problem with basically the slats would have a gap on the outside of the cup, right? So like if you look at the Whiskey Grail you've got, there is obviously there's like the inside of the joint and the outside of the joint. And so if the inside of the joint is tight and then the outside of the joint is loose, that means that our angle is off. And because this is octagonal, there is a basically the error factor is multiplied by 8 because that's how many joints you have. So even though every joint was only off by, I think it was like a quarter of a degree. I mean, it was minimal, but it was enough, right? Because that actually means you're off by 2 degrees over the whole cup. And so that makes gaps happen, and we can't have those. One of the things that we do at Whiskey Grail is we really try to keep, like, to me, quality is everything, right? Like, I want to make sure we're putting out really good product. And so if the quality is not there, I won't send a cup out. And that's sometimes can be tough, but I think it's the right decision in the long term. And so then it's like, okay, well, the angle's not right. Why isn't the angle right? What part of the process is responsible for the angle? And so you just follow that back. And for our particular manufacturing process, jig 3 is our is where we set our angle of our cups. And so I start looking at jig 3. I would tear apart the whole thing. And there were a couple different ideas I had that it could be. One of the things I thought initially was, okay, well, maybe somehow like the blade has gotten, right? Because if the blade is perfectly in line with the direction of travel for the jigs, it'll cut a flat surface. But because it's a circular saw blade, if you actually, if it's not in plane, if it's a little bit skewed to one side or the other, it'll actually cut an elliptical path as opposed to a straight path. So I was like, well, maybe that's the problem. So I looked at that and it was good. And then, you know, I checked my angle a couple different times, and it never occurred to me to check the angle of the platen of the actual jig until I just happened to turn it over to see, like, is there any debris on it or anything like that that's kicking one edge up? And that's when I found the damage to the jig. So it just kind of goes to show you, like, I mean, just the amount of precision that we have at Whiskey Grail that we require out of our process, and just the attention to detail that a lot of this stuff has is critical, right? I mean, right. It really is.
So. And you're hearing it first here from the owner, right? Like, there's a lot of passion that goes into this product. I mean, if you don't have quality, you have a cup, you don't have a Whiskey Grail, you're not putting it off the line. I can respect that.
Absolutely. And
it's interesting to, like, pick apart your engineering thought process and how the flowchart kind of goes to, I wanted to hear, how did you, like, you know, do the problem identification, right?
The breakdown. Yeah.
It's interesting to see how your mind works in that way.
And there's a couple other problems that were also present, right? So, like, there was some sloppy assembly. Like, I mean, some of our guys were just trying to move fast, and I had to say, like, hey guys, we're not about the speed. I mean, we want to move quickly, but we have to have the quality, right? So we had a team meeting on Tuesday as well, talk about that. And then, you know, what it ended up being was just, you know, I was pretty sure that we had solved the problem. So I went ahead and, let them keep going, but the temporary fix. So I did a temporary fix basically like Tuesday, like 1:30, just so that we could keep running the rest of the day. To try to kind of salvage the Tuesday production, because Monday pretty much was, it wasn't a total loss, but it was pretty bad, just because of that issue. And then, so Tuesday, I wanted to try to, like, let's try to go ahead and get some stuff out, get some time made up, and we did. So then it's Tuesday night, I came back and I fixed the root problem, reset the saw, reset up everything. And then I actually ran that process. I ran the whole process from jig one to jig three to assembly a handful of times, just to kind of make sure that, like, everything's good. I understand what the problem was, make sure that it's actually, you know, fixed. And then I sanded a bunch of the cups that we had assembled earlier in the day, again, just to make sure that that problem was solved. Because I really didn't want to go into Wednesday and miss another day of production because of this issue. So I was up until like 4 a.m. on Tuesday.
Sheesh.
So it's been, but we got the problem solved, right? So, like, that's kind of what matters, really, is we figured out the problem, we solved it, we're back up and running, we're moving, filling orders. We actually had, a shift today. We had a half shift today to try to help make up some of that time, and we did. So we've got about another 30 grails or so assembled today, which was good. And we're going to be back again tomorrow, just keeping making up time. We've got some people volunteering to come in over the weekend, which is great. So,
right on. Well, I guess that says more a testament to your like trusting your employees and your employees trusting you. You know, I can't imagine volunteering for more work, but it's a lot of passion that goes on in that.
Well, we are paying them.
No, of course. right, that's their weekend, right?
Yes, absolutely. And to be fair, like, it's not everybody, right? There's only a couple of us that are going to be in. There was four of us, five of us. There were five of us in today. There's going to be four, just the two of us. I think there's just going to be two of us in tomorrow. But, you know, to me, it's just like, I really just want to make up time and try to kind of make sure that we get all the orders that we can out as quickly as we can, because, you know, some of these people, they're ordered, you know, you know, we want to make sure that they get it before Christmas, because these are Christmas gifts and stuff like that. So we're really trying to push as many grails out the door as we can in these first couple of days of this week. And we're probably going to go ahead and bump up some of the shipping on some of them as well, just to make sure they get there on time. Just at no charge to the customer, but
right on.
You know,
Hey, that's quality service right there. I mean, non-biasedly, that's going above and beyond, putting in some extra work to get the job done right around the holidays. I can respect that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's all about the customer, right? Like, so, you know, they've put their faith in us to deliver a fantastic experience, a fantastic product. And, you know, it's not their fault that we had a problem at the production line, you know, on Monday or on Friday. You know, so the goal really is to make sure that they never realize that that happened.
Right. Right. Unless they listen to this podcast too.
Right. That's true. That's true. Unless they hear, but I don't want them to basically, you know, reach out to us and email like, hey, why isn't our grail there yet? And then us to have to say, I'm sorry, you know, like we had an issue with production. I never want to have to say that to a customer. Because it's just not good, right? It's just not how I want to do business. So it's been good. We've fixed the problems, and we should be set up for a decent week of production this week. And then we're going to be done on the 22nd, which is Friday, and then we're closed for the rest of the year.
Right on, man. Right across the finish line.
Yeah, man. Well, what about you? How's your week gone?
I got to say, this might be a bit longer of a preload because I got a story to tell you, Jim.
Oh, boy. Derek's, let's hear it. Let's hear
it. So the first half of the preload was about work ethic, and all of that. And that leads us right into my section of the preload, which is pleasure, right? Now, Jim, you've known me a long time. I personally don't think that I'm not a very materialistic person usually. If I buy something, it's usually quality, function, you know, in that order, and also necessity. Like I rarely celebrate my birthday. I rarely buy myself gifts or I'll get something I want every now and then. But at 25, I realized, I believe it was a Thoreau quote. I didn't want to get to the end of my life and know that I hadn't lived.
Yes.
So I made a purchase.
Yes. Oh boy.
Last week we talked a little bit about cars, right?
Oh, Derek, what did you get?
All right. So, you know, I've been wanting a project car for the better part of 3 or 4 years, right? Ooh. Something I can wrench on a little bit. And my mind has bounced around several times over the years. Like at first I thought I wanted a Corvette, you know, then I was like, ooh, let me get I kind of want an older car. And I don't really love how the like Corvettes I could afford really look. And yeah, that led me to Porsche. So, fun fact, my family, on my dad's side, I'm the first male in 2 generations that hasn't worked at General Motors, right? So, we're a General Motors car family. And I have my little Chevy Cruze. That's my daily rider. I have, as of this morning, purchased a 2000 Porsche Boxster.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Derek.
I'll get some pictures for you.
Please.
And I'm going to pick it up on Monday. The original plan was to get a crappier, you know, 1999 Boxster I've been looking at for a while, and someone bought it right from under me. And I was like, shoot, I'll just, you know, put it off a few months, keep looking, whatever. Well, I get a call from, I guess, whoever was selling me the car before, whatever dealership that was. And they're like, hey, we have a connection closer to you. We want to get you in contact. I look on their website, and what do they have? A 2000 Boxster, 97,000 miles, pristine condition compared to what I was trying to buy as a project car. And it's about the same price.
Perfect.
And it all fell together. You know, I went and set up the financing because, you know, I could buy it out of pocket, but I really want to just like pay on it a little bit every month. Okay. Excellent interest rate. I mean, it all kind of started falling into place, the insurance. And I'm going to go pick that sucker up on Monday. Let me send you a picture in chat.
Send me a picture. Yeah, please. Oh, that's awesome, Derek.
Yeah, I'm 25, man, and I figured if I'm going to have a quarter-life crisis, it might as well look so good.
You know what's funny, Derek?
What?
So I was at a Christmas party yesterday, and I was chatting with my, he's actually kind of my replacement at the Fab Lab, but he's a great guy. And he does more than what I did, to be fair. Like he does his job description is a bit broader, but he's kind of a car guy, and we were chatting, and I was talking about how I was looking at new for another car, like a reliable kind of daily driver type thing, and because you know the CRV, rest in peace, you know, has gone to the the car yard in the sky, as it were.
Yeah, across the rainbow suspension bridge.
I think I'm going to drag it back across the rainbow suspension bridge, but that's a project for later. So, okay. So the CRV, I love that car so much. So the CRV, right, it's blown a head gasket.
Okay. That's usually pretty catastrophic. Did it break the
block? Which is usually pretty, I don't think so. So it still runs, right? So I can actually, I turned it on yesterday. I moved it into the shop because I'm going to clean it out and like just like vacuum it out and get all the stuff out of it just so that it's not sitting in there.
Yeah.
Just because at some point I do want to try to kind of return to it because I feel like, I don't know, I get very emotionally invested in my stuff just because like I've just spent so much time with that car, you know?
Yeah, you put a lot of work in it too.
And a lot of work. And I know that I shouldn't get too invested. And like, if I can't do anything with it, that's fine. But I'm not just going to give up on it. Right? So especially because I looked into this, right? I can get a new or like a new used JDM motor, you know, less than 40,000 miles on it for like $1,000.
All right.
So now I'm like, okay, well, I've already swapped the transmission. I already know it's pretty easy. So, you know, so I'm just going to swap the engine, right? That's my thought. You know, so then if I'm swapping the engine, I may as well go ahead and get another transmission and transmission and down the rabbit hole we go. But anyway, that's a sidetrack. But anyway, so the CRV is going to be out of commission for the foreseeable future. So I was talking with Jonathan, who's you know, he's a bit of a car guy. He's got some car projects and stuff. And he's got, I think it's like a 98 Camaro.
Ooh.
And he was like, it's in really good shape. I've got a new transmission for it. I got a new water pump for it. The interior is mint, you know, and I need to get rid of it because if I keep it, I will keep spending money on it.
Hold up.
You know, so I was like, well, you know, I'm in the market for a vehicle. So I might have... So originally I was looking for something fairly practical and reliable and all that good stuff. And now I'm like, well, what if I got a sports car?
Well, like, did our quarter life crises sync up? We haven't talked all week and we're talking the same thing.
I really want to go look at it. He also was talking about a buddy of his. He's got like a 2018 or 19 Charger that he's also selling for like a pretty good price.
Mm-mm.
And I'm thinking of, I'm like, maybe. You don't think so?
Oh, no. Man, the only place I see it, no shame to the folks that like Chargers. If you like the car, you like the car, right? But if you want a muscle car that'll stay on the road, stay away from the Charger and the modern Mustangs. Right. Man, haven't we learned our lesson? You see those things peel at car meets or the car meet, which is 285 traffic in Atlanta. And you see that thing fishtailing six ways to sideways. And, you know, the driver's always just like, that's the only time they're ever polite. Just like, oopsie. But no, get a car that'll actually, you know, if you want to get down on it, it won't try to throw you off the road, you know?
That's fair. You know, I was actually, because I was thinking about this, right? Because, well, I don't know. I'm not really a big sports car guy generally, or muscle car. I don't know. I prefer a little bit more practicality.
But if not now, when, Jim?
Exactly, if right? If not,
that's
exactly
what I was thinking. You know, I was like, I work so hard. I've worked hard for years. My familial responsibilities have changed several times. You know, I'm taking on so much. I do so much for my family and some of my friends, and I always give out, and I'm giving. What have I given me? You know, was the what I came to. And I thought about it. I was like, oh, I'll just wait till I'm 30. But, you know, life can change in a heartbeat, right?
Yeah, man.
And, you know, we're at that age where, you know, we work hard enough to save a little money aside every now and then. And I'm very lucky to be in a pretty reasonable financial situation. Not rich, not poor, though. So that's ideal.
Right.
And I was like, you know, if not now, but like before you start having kids and, you know, have to worry about those bigger issues. But let me get the car I can jump in, pop the roof off,
and
look good doing it for a while.
I'm looking at Boxsters now. What color is it?
Did it come in chat? I got a jet black.
Ooh, that's going to be slick.
Did I not send it? Oh, I sent it to the pals. Let me send it to you. I've had problems with Discord the last few days. I'm glad that it's working today, though.
Yeah, apparently yesterday, one of my buddies, Brandon, apparently his, like, he had like 5 Discord servers temporarily go down. So I think there might be something happening.
Yeah, they had rolling outages like since Friday, but it seems to be pretty solid now. I just sent you the pics in chatting.
Weed. Oh, man, Derek.
You know what I mean?
That is slick.
You know, just, I mean, nothing fancy. Like, I'm not a Porsche guy. I'm not a very pompous person either, I don't think. I'm sure many various girlfriends would disagree, right? But love an old car. Exes. I mean, I like an old car. Somehow, either in the finance or insurance aspect, this counts as a classic car, which made me feel incredibly old. As a 98 baby, I'm like, 2000 is not classic, 70s is classic. What are you talking about?
I know,
about?
Right? I think you really got to get at least into the 80s.
That's what I thought. Right. But apparently, like, 23 years is enough.
That's bonkers.
Right? But no, it's a beautiful car. I'm really excited for it.
I guess it's 25. No, that'd be 98.
Yeah, so the Boxster came out in 96. Technically came out in 93 at the like road show in Detroit, but this is a 2000 on the dot. So I was like, you know,
okay.
Millennium car, it's timeless. I know some people have issues with like the headlights, the egg, they call it the fried egg headlights. I really have come to love them over the years, and the deal they gave me was just too good to be true. I was looking at one that needed a bunch of work. I had a long list of all the things I'd have to do to it. This one I can just drive off the lot. And anything I do is enhancement rather than getting it back to zero, you know?
Yeah, man, that's awesome. Do you mind, what did you end up with the APR, if you mind me asking?
Well, that was a whole nother story. I went through a credit union, and because it's such an old car, the dealership wasn't going to finance it. So I was like, let me contact my credit union, see what they can do. Folks were super nice. I'm not going to name the credit union, obviously, but
right.
They worked with me and they were like, you know, technically this counts as a classic car. I know you and I know it is not a classic car. So they helped me get a classic car loan. My credit was fantastic. Ladies, a little 800 for you. But I just pressed over 800 and I was like, you know what? Let's just apply for the classic car loan. They got me back with 5.2% over 3 years.
Oh, man. Dude, I'm getting gooned over here.
Well, it's a very specific situation, you know, like it's an older car, like it is known to appreciate in value. They saw my record and saw like, you know, no real accidents, and they were willing to work with me. So I really appreciate the credit union for pulling that together for me so quick.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, because I think last week when we talked, you know, I was looking at this, I was looking at a 2013 Toyota RAV4, right?
Right.
So Monday I go back in, and this is like part of all this is all happening at the same time, right? Because like Monday I spend like 4 hours at the dealership trying to figure this out on top of everything else happening with Whiskey Grail and stuff like that, which is kind of frustrating. But, you know, so I spend 4 hours at the dealership and they finally give me the paperwork of like, okay, this is what, you know, you're actually looking at. And they came back to me with like a 14% APR.
Sheesh.
Which
what?
I got good credit, bro. Like,
no, dude, a 14% APR, you could get a better personal loan than that. Come on,
exactly.
Now.
And I have good credit. Like, I'm kind of up there with you, you know. So I was like, this doesn't make any damn sense. So that ended up not working out. But so I'm gonna start looking around for something else. But
highly recommend. I've never worked with a credit union before this. If you can find one that's like kind of local, walk in and see what they say.
That's fair. Yeah. So there are some local credit union. I think I don't remember the name of the one near here, but that's a good idea. Yeah.
I didn't think about it. I was like, I remember back in the day my dad was around, he would, you know, he was a car guy, right? So he'd, you know, lease a car for a few years, you know, sell it, you know, kind of go through that process that most dads like that like cars do. And I remember he had, you know, the same credit union. So I was like, you know what? It's 15 minutes up the road. I'll go in. Worst case they can say is no. And the folks there, I gotta say, I have never had a pleasant banking experience. I'm fixing to move all my accounts with them straight up.
Like really?
Credit card and checking. I think I'm gonna keep my high yield savings because I got a AYP I just can't say no to right now.
Yep.
Right. Annual percentage rate, but it's
okay.
I was pleasantly surprised. Think of it. I started this process, I think, after the other car got away Friday. And they got me all the information over that Friday, like an hour or two in the store. I mean, the bank. And, you know, it's worth a look because the banks will run you cut and dry. We're young, you know. We are, for insurance at least, the most known to crash drivers, like that 18 to 25, 28 range, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I was really excited. I get it. Yeah, I was like, you know, come on now. I'm going to drive this thing like an old man. This is my pimping car.
It's my pimping car. Amazing.
Well, I guess we should probably get to the episode. I'll try to...
Nah. All right. I just had to adjust my screen settings a little bit.
Hey, no worries. One day we'll give them what they really want, which is a, you know, all preload show.
Just a preload.
Yeah, when we can't have an idea, if we ever get stuck, we should just talk for an hour.
We've been already talking for half an hour, so like we're pretty close. Amazing. So, final update before we go onto the preload. I'm going to Hawaii, baby.
Oh, I'm going to Hawaii, baby.
Yeah, dude. I'm going to Hawaii. So the dates have worked out. So I'm going to be able to go to Hawaii. I'm super excited. So after the show, we'll stay on for a few minutes and we'll figure out what flights and stuff I need to book.
Sounds good, man.
Because I am super excited.
Oh, I'm so glad it worked out for you. That's going to be amazing. I think we got a group of five problematic bachelors. That should be a fun trip.
Hell yes. Hell yes. I'm so excited. And March is going to be such a cluster for me because... So we're going to Hawaii.
Righto.
And then also I have potentially a 2-week obligation that I can't talk about yet.
Ooh.
And then also the robotics team that I help mentor has both of their competitions in the latter half of March. Sheesh. So March is just going to be a lot. But we'll
you're
going
to get off the plane and straight to work.
It really is. So it's going to be a stressful month, but it's going to be awesome. And I'm so looking forward to it.
Man, that's great news. I'm glad to hear it worked out for you, man.
I'm so excited. So, all right. Well, that's enough preload. We've been yakking for a hot minute. So let's jump into the episode. We're talking about San Francisco Bay, the Golden Gate Bridge today. I don't know if I have a good question to link into that because neither of us have really been out there. But so anyway, I guess we'll just jump into
Let's just jump right in. Oh, this is a good one. Well, we know how this story ends.
Yeah, so this is actually like a triumph of engineering. So the Golden Gate Bridge is actually considered to be one of the modern marvels of the world. And it's quite striking. It's beautiful. It spans nearly a mile for the actual suspension span. And the whole bridge itself is almost 2 miles long. It's quite large. It's a series of bridges because it kind of hits the banks of the river, and then there's like a couple other bridges that have to happen as well. But it's a huge bridge. It was the longest bridge in the world from 1937 until 1964, and it was the tallest bridge in the world until 1998.
That is wild. It was the king for 30 plus years.
Oh, yeah.
In a huge industrial period, too, like the span you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in fact, you know, it's still considered to be one of the most beautiful bridges in the United States, at the very least. And generally, you know, it's one of the most photographed bridges globally because it's just such a striking image. And the Golden Gate Bridge spans a structure. Well, it's a structure. It spans the opening of the bay, which is called the Golden Gate. That's the actual name of that strait that it crosses. And it connects the San Francisco Bay to the Pacific Ocean, and it divides kind of that northern and southern different parts of San Francisco. And there's very heavy fog there. It's obviously a very important route for trade, for the ports of San Francisco and for access to the Pacific Ocean.
And it's gorgeous. So that whole area is just really, really pretty.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, basically as long as San Francisco has been a major metropolis, there's kind of been some ideas about we should be putting a bridge up here because there's a lot of traffic that could go across it and would go across it. Because otherwise you have to circumnavigate like the entire bay which is quite large. You know, I don't know how long it would be to go around from point to point without crossing the bridge. But I mean, I would imagine it would take you the better part of probably a 4-hour drive.
At least.
I would have to imagine it in modern day.
You got to think about the scale of Cali. Like these distances, they're not straight lines like you see in like Texas or like in Kansas. No. Like you're curving around mountains, you know, some points going along the coast. It's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. It really is striking. But yeah, so, you know, people have been talking about having a bridge there for a long time, really since kind of like the mid 1800s. So, and in the early 1800s, there was actually a ferry service that was created, and there was a ferry service for like 100 years before the bridge was built. So in early as 1820, there was a regular scheduled ferry that was put in place to start transporting goods from the south to the north side.
And in 1940, business
was a booming. So in 1940, they're actually transporting like drinking water to San Francisco from the northern side. So I guess, I don't know. So I'm not too familiar with the geography of California.
You could literally say it's across the country.
It is across the country. So I'm looking at the Google Maps, and it does look like there's a lot more like lakes and streams on the north side than there is on the south side. Interesting. So anyway, they're transporting goods and water across the bay with this ferry. And that ferry continues to basically continue to be in service. Eventually, the ferry service is purchased by the Southern Pacific Railroad. And so that is going to end up being a little bit important because... So they're not actually transporting trains, but what they would basically have is there would be a train depot. The goods from the train would be offloaded onto the ferry, and then the ferry would then cross the strait.
Right, and I can't see any possibility of how a railroad buying the ferry service would hurt the business. I mean, surely it'll be fine.
Surely it'll be fine. So they also started to... make ferry passages for cars, right? So automobiles, like, you know,
you just drive on that bad boy.
Yeah, you drive onto the ferry, and then the ferry goes across and unloads, and you drive off and onto your next way. And to be fair, like, that's not a huge trip, right? So like the ferry ride is about a 30-minute ferry ride, which isn't
that's not bad at all.
But yeah, so San Francisco at the time, in, you know, the 1920s. Was the largest city in the United States still serviced primarily by ferries.
Interesting.
And because it didn't have like an established link to its surrounding communities, their growth rate was really, really slow compared to all the other growth rates of comparable cities across the United States. And of course, this is the boom in 20s. So that's a significant factor here. So basically... A lot of people were saying, we need a bridge. We need a bridge to be able to really lift San Francisco into the modern age and to get the economic growth and that we need to grow. And a lot of people said, we can't build a bridge here because the water is too deep, the current is too strong, there's fog that's going to obscure construction, there's heavy wind that could, you know, threaten the construction and threaten the workers who would be working on the bridge, all this stuff. So along comes a man we've talked about briefly in the past. His name is, I believe, Joseph Strauss. Am I blind? Yes, I was correct. That's right. It was Joseph Strauss. And so Joseph Strauss, at this point, he has like no experience building suspension bridges, which is great. But he's like, you know what would work here? A suspension bridge.
Big brain Strauss over here. And it's interesting that little detail you mentioned. It's like he's never had experience with suspension bridges and then goes on to build arguably the most iconic suspension bridge, if not in the world, at least in the United States.
Yes, yes. And so we'll get into this a little bit more, but Strauss was actually, Strauss is, oh man, how do you say this. So he was a little bit like Edison, right? In that, do you know kind of like how Thomas Edison kind of has become a little bit more infamous in recent years?
Not really. I don't know much about the history of Thomas Edison outside of his inventions.
So very quick aside. So Thomas Edison actually ran like an inventing house, right? So other people would come in and invent stuff in his workshops, basically.
Right.
And then he would just kind of put his name on their stuff.
Yeah, just slap the Edison tag on there and all of a sudden it's his project.
Exactly. So, a lot of the work that is attributed to Edison, in fact, was not done by Thomas Edison.
Hmm.
That's not to say Thomas Edison wasn't a very intelligent man and didn't invent a lot of good stuff, but he also was rather unscrupulous about stealing the work of others and claiming it as his own. Strauss is similar, although he's not quite as bad. But there are a couple of other designers and engineers that we definitely should talk about because they deserve the credit too.
Heck
so
yeah.
There's Charles Ellis. He was actually fired from the project and then, because he was just so obsessed with it, continued to work on the project unpaid. And then there's another name that we've talked about briefly in the past as well, Leon Moisseiff. Who came into our story about the Tacoma Narrows Bridge last week. He is also involved in this project quite heavily. So the people who are really doing the heavy lifting of the structural engineering, the project, are really Charles Ellis and Leon Moisseiff. And I think there's another one who is a consulting engineer, but his name I didn't write down because he's just a consulting engineer. But basically, the idea is that Strauss at the time was really heavily credited, but as time has come forward and kind of the details have come out, these other engineers really contributed very significantly and should be recognized as such.
Outstanding. It's good to, I know they're not really around now to get the credit, but it's good that history remembers them.
Yeah, and they should be. They should be remembered. So,
and they'll be remembered on this podcast.
Yeah.
Everything's a sprint, even the little guy. Who's
even
actually a pivotal
a
part of your project.
Even he's a spring. But yeah, so basically, in 2016, there was some stuff like starting to rumble about like, we should build a bridge pretty seriously. You know, the people have been thinking about it, but really, in 1916, they were starting to really get the hankering to build a bridge. Again, to expand the economic prospects of San Francisco.
And also, I can't stress this enough, suspension bridge pretty.
Suspension bridge, very pretty. and so the estimates at the time, they're like, this is going to cost $100 million, which in today's money is about $2.7 billion.
Sheesh.
And at the time, that was just completely out of reach. So along comes Joseph Strauss, and he's like, we can do this for $17 million.
Oh, I'm calling cap. Start to finish, no way.
And so that's about $500 million today. And he's like, we can do massive cantilevered suspension bridges and we can build this thing for $17 million. And people are like, well, that's doable. And so they start looking into it. So Strauss spends, and to Strauss's credit, I mean, he really was kind of the lead guy for this bridge, right? He just didn't do a lot of the engineering.
That's fair. But, call
so
it what it is, right?
He's still a very important part of the project. So, because he spends like more than a decade, like pushing to get support for the project, to get funding for the project, to get the local counties to like buy into the project, basically. Because there's a lot of people who don't want this to happen.
Big Ferry, probably.
Yeah, Big Ferry does not want this bridge to happen.
No, wait.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, the Southern Pacific Railroad, which, by the way, is a huge powerhouse in this area of the country because it's the railroad.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be a shame if your stuff got stuck in port.
Yeah, they are very opposed to the bridge because it would destroy their ferry service, basically, which is very profitable right now.
So you just simply buy Big Ferry. In the area.
Well, Big Ferry kind of did it to themselves. So
don't do it.
So what happens is basically, the Southern Pacific Railroad tries to start a lawsuit to stop the bridge. And then the people of California are like, this is stupid. And they boycott the ferry service.
Oh, so the PR turned on them so much.
The PR turned on them. Exactly right. So, you know, say what you will about California, but you know what the Californians used to not be?
The Californians.
You got to give it to the Californians of the 1920s and 30s. They weren't no bootlickers.
Hey, we had they were willing to get the picket out and like that's American values. Like peaceful protest has been a part of our culture for after we decided to be peaceful. Sometimes before it was just like I'm gonna revolt.
Yeah, it's like let me get my musket, you know. But yeah. Oh geez. Yeah.
But no, that's interesting how it's so entangled. Like the fact that the railroad could get such a demanding stake in the ferry business. Because like you said, they're a powerhouse.
They're a powerhouse and they just have money. You know, like, that's the thing, right?
You can throw lawsuits out of the window if you can just keep paying for them until the little guy can't. That's the unfortunate truth about our legal system.
Exactly. It really is quite bad. But but they got boycotted and kind of ruined that way, which is good.
One for the people. Let's go.
But yeah, like so the local like unions, for, like building unions and stuff, they want to make sure that like local workers are going to be able to work on the bridge and get benefit from that.
You know, I love a good
Navy,
union.
The Navy is actually very concerned about sabotage to the bridge potentially or a collision blocking the port, basically, which would be really, really bad because it's a huge port.
Right. I'm sure they have some naval assets up there, just like they do in San Diego.
Definitely. Definitely some naval assets there. So you know, there's definitely some concern about like what this bridge could mean if it isn't implemented correctly. But in 1924, there's a hearing for the bridge, basically to they want to use some of federal land in order to construct a bridge in order to like for like the landings basically. And eventually they get it passed through. And the state of California, they actually create a special body to actually build the bridge, right?
That's a pretty big project.
And that's
project.
Established, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's a huge project. So the body is established in 1923, and their goal is how do we design, build, and finance the construction of this bridge? And most of the counties around California, or in this area of California, end up having a voice on this district, on this body. And for some reason, it's called a district, which I don't really understand, but hey, it's what it is.
Is it District 9?
I don't know. I don't think so. That was a good movie, though. I like that movie. So Joseph Strauss is the chief engineer of this project, right? And that doesn't actually mean that he's doing the majority of the engineering work. It just means he's the leader of the engineering team. And that's an important distinction.
Okay.
Because Strauss's original design is actually rejected because it's really ugly. And so they bring in some of these other people. Leon Moisif, we talked about earlier, is actually the person who puts together the final design for the Golden Gate Bridge, is Leon Moisif.
That's an interesting little piece of history there.
It
like
is.
Strauss's design wasn't the one they went with.
It was not. Yeah, no. So there's another guy named Irving Moreau, who is also he's a residential architect local to the San Francisco area. And it's his Art Deco design elements that are incorporated into the bridge that give it such an iconic look, basically. So like the streetlights, the railings, the walkways, the tower decoration, all that comes from Irving Moreau. Even the color. So international orange is the official color of the bridge. And it was picked. It was personally picked and selected by Moreau. And that is why we have such this beautiful orange bridge. And there were other ideas. So like the Navy wanted to paint it black and yellow stripes.
It's the Navy. I wouldn't be surprised if they're just like, listen, it's a strategic target. Paint it in zebra print. It's the 20s. Do it. Do it now.
we got to make sure they can't lock onto it with their torpedoes.
No, I'm glad the Navy didn't get the final say in that. Because, you know, as we saw working for
it'd
like...
It'd be an eyesore.
Yeah, it's what's cheap ain't always what's pretty. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
That orange is so gorgeous. It's timeless. Yeah. Truly.
Absolutely. But, yeah, so back to Charles Ellis. Charles Ellis is collaborating on the design with with Moisif. And he is helping substantially with, we talked a little bit about deflection theory last week about the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. And that's this idea that this thin, flexible roadway actually reduces the stress significantly that's transmitted through the cables, right? Or rather, the suspension cables can help take some of that stress. The Golden Gate Bridge fundamentally follows the same design as the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, right? And so this actually raises a lot of concern when the Tacoma Narrows Bridge fails catastrophically, a scant 2 years after its construction, because of the aeroelastic flutter. There's a couple reasons that the Golden Gate Bridge does not suffer from such severe aerodynamic flutter as the Tacoma Narrow Bridges suffered from. A big factor of it is that it is significantly bigger,
right,
and deeper, and because of its size and because of the massive span that it has to cross, the trusses, or it's actually a trussed construction, right? So the road bridge has trusses. If we remember about the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, it was an 8-foot sheet of steel with no holes in it.
Right.
So basically, the Golden Gate Bridge, even though it's a much larger like height, there's less cross-sectional area for the wind to catch on. So the wind cannot affect it as much because there's basically less sail area, if you want to look at it that way.
So like making those big triangular cuts is what makes it more aerodynamic?
It helps with it's not necessarily like aerodynamic. What it does is it helps reduce the aerodynamic loading on the bridge because there's more gaps that the air can flow through.
There's less to, you're catching less drag.
You're exactly. You're catching less drag. The wind has less area to affect it. Right. So a lot of times like we think of wind as a push, you know, the wind is pushing on something, but really what it is, it's a pressure, right? So, and the force generated by pressure is a direct function of the area that it is acting upon. So if you can reduce the area that the wind has to act on, or in that case, you're reducing the area that the pressure is put on, you reduce the amount of force that's actually being put onto the structure. Hmm. And so that's why this works.
Good old F equals or MA. One of the well, reasons. Well explained by Jim.
There you go. So Ellis is also helping a lot with this. He also is actually building this particular part of the bridge structure. So on the south side of the bay of the gate, there's this pre-Civil War era fort. Basically. And at that point, even at that point, it was viewed as an important historical thing.
Okay.
So they wanted to preserve it. So Ellis actually designs this steel arch bridge that actually goes over the fort. So it preserves this historically significant architecture. Which is important.
Yeah, as long as you don't like throw your milkshake off the side of the bridge, it's restored. We're good.
Yeah, it's fair. That's fair. So Ellis, unfortunately, he doesn't receive any of the credit in his lifetime for the work that he does on this bridge. And Strauss actually fires Ellis in 1931 and replaces him with kind of a colleague of his. It's kind of nepotistic or whatever. This is kind of a problem. I don't know. Like, this is not very ethical, right? Because Ellis is so obsessed with this project. And I think it's like to a certain extent, you have to know, like, this is going to be, like, this project is going to be such a huge part of history. And
right.
Such a huge engineering thing.
And also his own personal history. Like, this is your magnum opus if you're working on this thing.
Yeah, I mean, he's been working on this for years at this point, right? And so just be let go from it. He just can't handle it. So he still keeps working, you know, 70 hours a week. He's working on this project, unpaid.
Where's the passion? Oh, it's there.
Yeah, it's right there. It's right there. And like, to me, like, that's so key, is like, you can tell projects that have people like this behind, right? Where it's like, no, this guy had to fight for every part of this project.
And to not even get your name on it, like, in your lifetime.
Yeah.
And that not be the main concern. It's just like, I put so much work into this. I care about this project so much. I want to make sure it is what I dream it can be, even if I don't get the credit. And there's a lot of humility in that, honestly. It's not fair.
Absolutely.
But it's, we're going to respect you today, Mr. Ellis. We remember you.
Yeah. Shout out to Ellis. Shout out to Charles Ellis. But yeah, so he turns in like 10 volumes of calculations for this bridge. So, and again, this is before computers. So all the calculations for these bridges are done by hand, you know, to prove out that they've got to, you know, got to stand up.
In this generation of engineering, are they simply using like linear algebra? This is before the freaking space race.
It is. So mathematics is actually a fairly old study. So there are, I think calculus is pretty well developed at this point in time. So they're probably, I mean, I'm not entirely sure what the mathematics looks like at the time, to be honest with you. I would imagine it looks fairly similar to a lot of the basic engineering calculus that we have today, just because the laws of physics have not changed.
Oh, so, shame. I was looking for the next update.
I know, right? I would love... Well, I'm actually very... There's some really interesting things going on in physics right now, and specifically in terms of cosmology with the James Webb Space Telescope, which is definitely an episode we should get Kasha involved in.
Oh.
Because she would be a much better person to speak to that than I would be.
For sure, I mean, it is awesome. A beautiful project. Like, there's beauty in engineering that I didn't appreciate when I was younger. Because I would look at bridges as a structure instead of, like, appreciating the architectural aspects of it as well. And it's interesting, you hear, like, just hearing you kind of piece the history together of this bridge and how it really does take a village of experts. Like, not to take away credit from anybody, you know, Charles Strauss, I'm sure project management on a thing this large is not easy. Nepotism aside, you know, you got folks like Ellis with just raw exuding passion on something you've worked on for decades and not willing to let it go, even in getting fired. There's like, I can't imagine putting myself in that position and having the same reaction, you know?
Right. Yeah. No, I'd be mad as hell.
I didn't want to say it, but I'd be pissed.
I'd be mad pissed.
I'm building another bridge of my own design.
I'm throwing a couple of pictures your way from the Wikipedia page. Dude. Just to kind of give you an idea for the span of the bridge.
Now that is a big bridge.
It is a big bridge. So like the total bank to bank full span of the bridge is like 2 kilometers, which in freedom units is like 8,000 feet. And then the actual span, the suspension span, is 1,280 meters, which I believe is about 4,000 feet. So,
now, quick question for you, Jim. Looking at this diagram picture here, if you look on the, like, as we're looking at it here, the left side, where that little, I don't know what to call it, that sub architecture, that sub arc on the left, is that where the memorial is?
Yeah. So that's what Charles Ellis designed to basically prevent having to demolish this pre-Civil War fortification.
And it's interesting. Yeah. You can make something that's technically not symmetrical to the rest of the structure also beautiful. And it has this little story to it.
Yes. And the whole, the whole bridge is really this, I mean, it is like this work of art, right? And that, to me, is like another huge part of engineering, is so much beyond just the raw calculations and the raw physics of it. It's also like, you know, can we make things that are beautiful too?
Right, like,
you know, and
function skill, and beauty.
Yes, absolutely. The marriage of beauty and function, to me, is incredibly inspiring.
It's like they could have easily made a older like style, you know, or just done a cookie cutter. Oh, here's this bridge. We're just going to scale it up. It's not the prettiest, but you know, here's all this concrete. You know what I'm saying? It's truly breathtaking and a small dream of mine now. You know, we got to see if we can drive our future quarter life crisis cars over that bad boy.
Ah, oh, that'd be fun.
I mean, yeah, it's just look at that sunset. It's gorgeous.
It's beautiful. Absolutely. But yeah, so construction begins January 5th, 1933. And the project ends up costing a little bit more than $35 million.
Oh, so they doubled their budget just about?
Yes. but that's still only $590 million in today's money.
Yeah, we build this today, that's $1 billion.
And guess what, Derek?
I'm guess. What you got?
Would you consider? Would you imagine that this bridge would be completed ahead of schedule or behind schedule?
Project of this scale, all of the hiring issues we've already talked about, the buttings of heads, I'd have to say after. It had to take longer.
All right. And do you think it would come in over budget or under budget?
I'm guessing over, right? Well, is this after the budget adjustment or before?
After the budget adjustment.
I'd assume they also went a little over, like they kicked past 35.
Well, Derek, say what you will about Joseph Strauss's narcissistic tendencies, but his project came in ahead of schedule and under budget by $1.3 million.
Wow. So outstanding. Which, I mean, he's really just, they should call him what he is, the project manager of the
Golden Gate Bridge. He's the project manager, yeah. And to be fair, he does a lot of really good stuff. So he's actually really innovative in the use this time of safety netting underneath men who are working on the bridge, which saves a lot of lives. So 19 men are saved by the nets over the course of the project.
Wow. That's really forward thinking too. Cause like, well, this is, you got to think about the time period, William. Some of the like pictures of the Empire State Building construction is one of the most famous pictures of all times of those workers just sitting on an I-beam eating lunch. Right. And it's been, you know, replicated through photography for years. The fact that he was like, you know, I'm not going to be responsible. I understand what needs to go into this. I understand this is going to be folks sitting on like older cranes and lifts. Yeah, that picture right there. It's interesting that he was forward thinking enough and even cared enough about the workers to, you know, add that little addition. And he proved it. Safety measures don't have to be over budget. You can get it done.
Yeah, and the thing too is, you know, that picture was taken in 1932. You know, so this is just a year later. I mean, this is relatively, I mean, yeah. So
interesting.
He truly is, you know, looking out for his workers. And unfortunately, there are still some deaths involved with the construction. So there's 11 people or 10 people, 11. There's 11 men who are killed in falls over the course of the bridge. 10 of those people die when a scaffold falls into the nets and breaks them and takes the 12 people that was on the scaffold with it. And then two of those 12 people survived the fall into the water, but the other 10 did not.
That is a sizable drop, even from the lowest point of the, like where the bridge is actually in use.
Yeah, absolutely. It's pretty incredible. It is a very high bridge, right? Mm. And part of the reason it's so high is to make sure that the shipping traffic was never impeded.
Now, Jim, I have a question that's less engineering, right? We're looking at this picture now, right? And we've seen the Golden Gate Bridge. We know as scientists and engineers that California has a problem coming up in the next couple decades with, you know, rising seawater, you know, talks about having to build seawalls. How does climate changes like that, that we know are on the horizon at our current rate, affect a bridge like this, in your opinion?
Ooh, so that's actually a really interesting question. And I don't know that I'm really the right person to answer this, so keep this with a grain of salt. My initial greatest concern would actually be the pilings of the bridge, right? So because, you know, basically your idea is that the Golden Gate Bridge, these two spans that are on the banks of the gate, right? The banks of the straits that it crosses. Mm-hmm. They're designed to have, you know, basically, like, the water level is only supposed to come up so high on that.
Right. That was my concern, because you can kind of see in closer pictures the water line. Like, there's, of course, wearing on the actual structure itself, so you can see where the water usually averages.
So, basically, the pilings are basically they look like these little concrete islands. And then the steel structure of the bridge is mounted to it. So, my concern would basically be that if the sea level rises far enough, that you start to have the steel come into contact with the ocean water, that is going to corrode the bridge relatively fast. And so you'd have to take some sort of measure to protect it, which could be challenging or very expensive or both. And I don't know how they would actually... I'm not sure what the best way to solve that problem would be. I suppose what you could do is basically pour concrete higher around it to prevent the water from getting to the steel. But that prevents that kind of creates its own complications and problems. To be honest, I don't know what the best answer would be to help protect a bridge like this. One of the advantages that the Golden Gate Bridge has in particular against that kind of climate change damage is that the banks of the Golden Gate Straits are actually quite high. So, like, the ends of the bridge are very, obviously, very high above sea level. So the only thing you'd really have to be too worried about is the pilings. And I think that those are tall enough that you'd have to see a pretty significant sea level rise to really start to worry about that too much.
Right on. Although, again, and at that point, you're not really worried about the bridge more than everything else down coast.
Yeah, right. Like, that is a whole different problem. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, sorry to sideline this a little bit. I was looking at the diagram, and I'm just like, I wonder how strong it would be, because it's gotten, what, over 80 years of stress already?
Yeah. Yeah, now one thing that might be a problem, right, is if you have rising sea level, your tide is actually going to be stronger, right? So potentially, and because the depth of the pilings would be increased, if that makes sense, right? Like, so if you look at the pilings, if those become more submerged, you would have a deeper flowing water channel, basically. And so maybe your concern then would be, okay, now you have a faster water stream. What is that going to do to the pilings? Are the pilings going to be able to withstand that additional force?
And I guess less clearance for ships. Like, these are things I've never thought about. I just kind of had the question. But I guess, hey, future generations of engineers, if you're listening, and folks in school right now, there's a free Nobel Prize on the table if you can be the end-all, be-all on how to save bridges if we end up with rising sea levels across the world.
Yeah, that'd be an interesting thing to look at in a little bit more detail. But I'm not sure what it would be off the top of my head.
It's like aggressively buys ANSYS simulation.
Yeah. Now, there is some really interesting things that people have done. So I think last week we talked briefly about they've actually built like a scale model of the Golden Gate, of the San Francisco Bay.
Yeah, I think we showed a little bit of that at the end of one of our episodes. Was that Tacoma? That Bay Area model that the Army Corps of Engineers did?
Yeah, so the Army Corps of Engineers created the Bay model, which is this giant hydraulic replica of the San Francisco Bay Area. And that is actually something that they probably could replicate in this scale model in terms of being able to tell a little bit more about how that higher sea levels might affect the pilings and the towers and the maybe some of the concerns that might come with that, if that makes sense.
Outstanding. I'm sure it'll be easy, not easy, but it would be practical to like section off a part of that model that involves the Bay Area, so of that Golden Gate Bridge, so they don't flood the rest of it, but just kind of, you know, get some calculations early.
Right. Well, I think the thing is you'd have to, right? You'd almost have to flood the rest of it because you'd be looking at really like the tide changes, right? So like how does that increased volume of water affect the tide? Mm. And like the tide velocity.
What gets toppled over instantly?
Yeah, like what gets pushed around by the tide? Because the sea is an incredibly destructive, or can be an incredibly destructive force.
Oh, as sailors have known for years, the sea don't care about you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So that would be my primary concern with the rising sea level, is to make sure the pilings would be able to stand up to the additional loading, which I would imagine that they would be able to, but I don't have the actual numbers on the pilings and design of the pilings, so that I can't say for sure. But
that's just a theory.
But just a game theory.
Sorry, Matt, please don't sue us.
Anyway, back to the topic at hand. What were we even talking about?
I think the Golden Gate Bridge, if I remember correctly.
Ah, that's right. That's right. The Golden Gate Bridge. Yeah, so Strauss actually does innovate, and he does have a lot of really good... I guess he performs his role as kind of design lead or project manager very well. Including looking after his workers, which is excellent.
I don't want to take away credit where it may be due, but I would almost guarantee that's pressure from the unions, right? Which is why unions
could be.
Are
certainly,
so important,
could be.
You know?
Certainly. That absolutely probably could, that probably was or could have been part of it. I don't know for sure, but absolutely. That's absolutely right. The bridge finally opens on May 27th, 1937, and there's a lot of people who are credited with being a part of the project, and we'll talk about the engineering staff specifically, just because that's kind of what we're talking about here. And this plaque is actually on the Golden Gate Bridge, and it lists the contractors, the engineering staff, the directors, the officers who were in charge of it. And so the engineering staff is listed as follows. Chief Engineer Joseph Strauss, Principal Assistant Engineer Clifford Payne. This is the man who was basically was hired to replace Charles Ellis.
Wait, they didn't even put him on the plaque?
He is not on the plaque.
Oh,
he is not on the plaque.
Man.
Then there's the resident engineer Russell Cohn, the assistant engineer Charles Clara Hahn. And then Dwight Netherell and the consulting engineers, O.H. Amon, Charles Derelith Jr., and Leon Moisif. And then there's a consulting traffic engineer, Sidney Taylor.
We did talk about Amon before, didn't we?
I believe Tacoma he's Narrows? Popped up. He does sound pretty familiar. So he may be.
So the folks on this plaque at the time, they are Big Bridge now.
They are Big Bridge. Yeah, these guys are Big Bridge. Absolutely. And, but notice again that Joseph Strauss, a lot of the credit that's associated with the design of the bridge probably should go to, Leon Moisif and, Charles Ellis. And they are in one case, you know, not listed, and the other just listed as a consulting engineer. So he definitely downplays the role of some of his compatriots in their design and in terms of the bridge to kind of take that credit for himself, which is kind of shady and unfortunate.
It's an interesting little truth there. Like, you know, like the plaques only tell half the story. And you usually hear this in war where it's like the spoils go to the victors, or where they write the history of how things go down, which is true. Even in smaller there's conflict even in these, what we would call, you know, like more white collar engineering jobs, right?
Absolutely.
I guess blue collar on the construction, white collar more on the design and effectiveness of that.
That's right.
That's really interesting, Jim. Like the pettiness to you. Not only is this guy not saying, all right, you're firing me, I'm wiping my hands of it, you're not getting any of my drawings, do the calculations again. He handed over all of the useful information he could.
He kept working on it.
Exactly.
He kept working on it.
As a passion project. Like there's some power in that. And I'm glad that you mentioned it, because we got to remember these folks that kind of get pushed to the side in history. There's a huge statue of Joseph Strauss at the Golden Gate Bridge. They didn't even put Ellis's name there.
Exactly.
That's a shame.
It is. So, the festivities about the opening bridge are pretty incredible, right? So, you know, the bridge opening celebration is on the, you know, obviously on May 27th, 1937, and it lasts for like a week.
Oh, they were getting down with this.
These people getting down on it.
Oh, I'm sorry. They're boogieing. This was before Boogie. So they were like throwing their hat in the air.
Yeah, I don't know what the dances in the 20s and 30s were. I guess like 1937.
Are we all flappers like at this point?
I feel like that was 20s. What? I'm going to Google it. What dances were popular in the 1930s?
Sorry, folks who weren't around wouldn't know.
Ah, the rumba.
The rumba.
The rumba, samba, and the foxtrot and the waltz.
Oh, the foxtrot and waltz are pretty popular, yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. You go on down to the Golden Gate Bridge opening or celebration.
The jitterbug. There's the jitterbug, too.
That's the jitterbug. Kind of now a popular phone for old folks before getting down with your best gal.
With your best gal. Come down to the Golden Gate Bridge and get down with your best gal on the Golden Gate Bridge.
1 week of festivities, we are not going to have any cars across it because we are boogieing. Oh, to be a radio announcer in the 30s.
Oh, that'd be fun. All right, here is a picture of the jitterbug. I don't know. It's just,
oh, look, she's getting down. You even though it's a still picture, you can tell. Isn't that the face of joy?
Look at those rosy cheeks.
Oh, there we go.
Anyway, so yeah, but anyway, so they spend like a week celebrating this thing, and you know, there's this whole ceremonial crossing of the bridge, and then there's a blockade of beauty queens who require Joseph Strauss to present the bridge to the highway district before they let him go by. There's singing and there's dancing. And then the next day, President Roosevelt pushes a button in Washington, D.C. that gives the green light to start vehicle traffic over the bridge.
Do you need a button for that?
Fiesta. I don't know. It's in the 1930s. They liked buttons.
Ceremonial button.
Exactly. but yeah, so there's a week of structural and civil activities called the Fiesta, to celebrate the opening of the Golden Gate Bridge. So then, there's actually in 1951, the Golden Gate Bridge, one of the fascinating things to me about the Golden Gate Bridge is that it's kind of this living piece of architecture because it's actually been retrofitted and improved several times over the past nearly 100 years of its existence.
Oh, so it just kind of goes along with the technological advancements of the day?
Yeah, yeah. So the first significant retrofit occurs in 1951 and 1952. It goes from 1951 to 1954. So there's a windstorm, a heavy windstorm, on December 1st of 1951 that reveals some of the swaying and rolling instabilities of the bridge. And they closed the bridge pretty quickly.
Smart.
Because this is exactly what happened, basically, to the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, which catastrophically failed, I believe it was 42? I don't remember. Anyway, and so they're very concerned that this might happen with the Golden Gate Bridge. And they end up putting in additional torsional bracing. And so basically they retrofitted with lateral and diagonal bracing, connecting the lower structure to the upper structure of the trusses, basically. And so that stiffens the bridge so it doesn't twist quite so much. And actually the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, so I know we talked a little bit last week about the research that had gone into the Tacoma Narrows Bridge to fix it, basically.
Right. But they were too late.
And we talked, they were too late. They finished, basically, you know, they finished their research and they had submitted their suggestions of like, how do we fix this bridge? And then like 2 weeks later, the bridge collapses. But it wasn't too late for the Golden Gate Bridge. And so a lot of that research and a lot of that theoretical work that had gone into the Tacoma Narrows Bridge gets rolled into the retrofits for the Golden Gate Bridge. And basically helps prevent the twisting and motion and swaying motions that would could have destroyed the Golden Gate Bridge. So it's, again, like, I think it's important to recognize how these engineering failures actually are learned. We learn from those failures and we turn around and we use them where we can to prevent failure in the future.
Like proactively.
Proactively. Because to me, like engineering is a very, it's very much like an iterative process. You try something, you have to see if it works. Hopefully you see if it works in calculation or in scale model first, but then you learn from it and then you make it better. And so it's all about this incremental improvement. So that is the first primary retrofit. So then in the 80s, in 1982 to 1986.
Now we're boogieing.
There is the second major retrofit to the bridge. And Derek, the original bridge used a concrete deck, right? So the roadway and all that was made out of concrete. And it was actually reinforced concrete. What, Derek, do you think might be the problem with using reinforced concrete in such close proximity to the ocean?
Well, Jim, I don't know much about the ocean. There's a lot of water in that hoe, a lot of salt water.
There's a lot of salt water in that hoe.
And I know from our previous talkings about cavitation in these structures, that's a lot of concrete. That's going with a lot of forces. And it's probably going to end up cracking over time, making the road less and less safe. I don't know how to solve that one.
So basically, yeah. So what happens, right? We talked a little bit about this last week. So the salt carried by the fog and the mist reaches the rebar in the concrete through these little cracks, right? And again, as steel corrodes, it actually expands. And this causes what's called spalling in the concrete. We talked a little bit about that last week. And I believe actually a couple of weeks ago in our discussion about the Angers suspension bridge, we talked about concrete spalling. And what this means is that basically the concrete is bursting apart because the steel rebar inside of it is expanding and rupturing the concrete. And that does significantly reduce the strength of the concrete. So there are some concerns about this. And so in between 1982 and 1986, the original deck is systematically replaced with steel orthotropic deck panels. And steel orthotropic deck panels are really incredible structures because they're actually, they're lighter and they're stronger than the concrete, and they contribute more to the stiffness of the bridge than the concrete did. So it's basically all benefit, right? So it all strengthens the bridge.
That's interesting because you don't really think of concrete as a flexible material, but I guess in relative terms, you know, it does have a lot of flex to it.
Absolutely. And because it's all made out of steel, this new orthotropic deck can be made basically like thicker than the concrete, which means it's going to be a lot more resistant to bending. But it's also lighter because it's mostly hollow, actually.
Oh, okay.
So all orthotropic basically means is it basically is like a massive corrugated sheet of steel is what it looks like from the underside. So basically it's the deck is basically just an engineered structure. And so it can be engineered for more stiffness than the original concrete structure would have been able to yield. So that's basically like a direct upgrade to the original structure.
And it makes the bridge overall lighter too. Do they have to adjust any of the tension, or is it a negligible amount of weight where you can just kind of, okay. I don't know how, I know that we talked about the tuning of some of the dampening, but how specific are the tensions of the bridge itself?
So the tension of the bridge is actually not horribly sensitive to like a reduction in weight.
Okay.
And the reduction in weight is significant, right? So like the weight savings that the Golden Gate Bridge experienced is 12,300 tons.
Wow.
That's a lot of weight that they are saving. So really like it's the project really didn't just restore the bridge. It actually made it like better than new.
Hey,
because you now actually have a lot more load capacity because you no longer are supporting that dead weight of the bridge. You've reduced the bridge weight, basically the dead weight of the bridge, by 12,000 tons. And that means you can actually hold a lot more weight with the same cables and all this.
Yeah, so I'm sure there are definitely like weight restrictions now on bridges like this, but I bet that increased it greatly. It's like, if you want to fill your truck with concrete and come across, come on down. Yep. And just for my reference, and I don't know much. Is the Golden Gate Bridge only road traffic, or is it also road pedestrian, or is there rail?
So there's no rail. There actually was an idea to put rail traffic across the Golden Gate Bridge, but they end up saying that that's a bad idea because basically that additional loading would be just too much, and so they end up not doing that. But there is it's a 6-lane highway basically.
Sheesh.
So a lot of cars. And then there is a bicycle lane, and there is also a pedestrian crossing. So,
oh, you can go on it and like take pictures and stuff. That's cool.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. So there's pedestrian, and then there's also bike, and obviously 6 lanes of traffic.
Yeah, I know you were talking a little bit about your potential car, that little muscle car that you were mentioning earlier. I mean, take the top down, drive across the bridge, maybe do a little side episode like Top Gear.
Oh, that'd be fun. You know what I'm saying? Be great. We absolutely should do that. So that's interesting. So then one interesting event that I want to talk about real quick is actually the 50th anniversary celebration of the bridge. So basically, there's a 50th anniversary celebration in 1987, and the Golden Gate Bridge Authority, basically, they're like, we're going to close it to automobile traffic, and it's just going to be open to pedestrians.
Oh, that's awesome.
All 6 lanes, so that everybody can cross it on May 24th. And basically, like, a million people show up, and there's not enough crowd control to prevent all these people from going onto the bridge at once. So there's, like, 300,000 people on the bridge, which caused the center span of the bridge to like flatten out because of all the weight of the people.
So like, that is that more weight than like a full lane of like 6 lanes backed up traffic of cars and trucks? It's
apparently
the people.
So
I guess you're more tightly packed. So
yeah, and like you actually have to remember, like, people are pretty heavy because people are 70% water, and water's very heavy, right? So water is like 8 pounds per gallon.
Because people thirsty, Jim.
People thirsty. Them thirsty hoes be weighing heavy. and so people were kind of concerned about that, but they were like, okay, like, the bridge obviously didn't collapse, and they estimate that only 40% of the yielding stress of the suspension cables was reached. So there's a very large safety factor of the Golden Gate Bridge that has, which is good.
I bet it was a great day that day in, it 84? Or 87? In 87, to be an engineer, because now you're actually being able to stop and see, like, parts of the bridge that aren't usually accessible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. And then, during the 75th anniversary of the bridge opening, they decide we're not going to allow everybody just to walk onto the bridge willy-nilly because we don't want that to happen again.
Yeah, we get you a little ticket. You know, you get across, you know, you got your 45 minutes to take it all in and then get out of here.
Get out of here, exactly. So pretty interesting history for the Golden Gate Bridge. The Golden Gate Bridge is kind of a crazy structure. So, like, if you look at the suspension cables, right, they're incredible. So each cable is made up of 27,500 strands of wire individually.
Sheesh.
And they're all sheathed in this like steel, basically to prevent corrosion. They're sheathed in this like steel shell outer jacket. And the main cables are 36.5 inches wide in diameter.
Right,
they're enormous.
Kidding.
They're absolutely enormous. They're
you,
under
you
like
said 36
an
inches. That's
3 feet,
right?
They're 3 feet wide.
Wow.
Like, there's actually a walkway on top of the suspension cables for maintenance.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Like, that's how big these cables are.
These cables are half a gym wide.
They're half, yeah, they're half, they're half a derrick wide. And, yeah, so it's just incredible. And again, like, aesthetics are a big part of the bridge. The lights, the structure itself, the Art Deco elements. It's a really incredible bridge. And it is a toll bridge. You got to pay to cross it on by car. You can cross it for free by foot or by bicycle. And again, because of one of the other things I want to talk about very quickly, we are running hella overtime tonight, but
hey, maybe this is the longest episode of Everything's a Spring.
There you go. Everything's a spring, even our podcast time.
Exactly. It compresses. We got stuff to talk about. We're going to talk, folks.
We're going to talk about it. So there is like some environmental factors that are kind of a big deal, right? So San Francisco, obviously there's very high winds.
Hmm.
And the Golden Gate Bridge is designed to sustain, to safely withstand winds, you know, up to like almost 70 miles an hour. And the bridge has only ever been closed like 3 or 4 times, you know, because of high wind.
Hey, that ain't bad for the life
of it. Which is pretty good. And then one of the big concerns at a certain point about the structure, and one of the most recent retrofits to the Golden Gate Bridge are actually to improve the seismic resistance of the bridge, right? Because obviously the San Andreas Fault is very close to San Francisco. And so there's a lot of concern about the bridge being vulnerable to earthquakes.
Yeah, the cursed shaky shaky.
Yeah. And so basically because the structure was so big, I guess there was this idea that it was going to be fine. It was going to be able to withstand any magnitude of a foreseeable earthquake or whatever.
Don't worry about
it. But ultimately, there were some supports that failed in the arch over Fort Point, which is that historic structure that we talked about earlier. Okay. So the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989 is what caused the collapse of some of the support structures for that little archway that goes over Fort Point. And that was a pretty big earthquake. So that, I believe, was a 7.2.
Ooh.
No, that was not. 7.2 earthquake happens in 1992. But regardless, it's a sizable earthquake. It's quite large. Okay, so basically they're doing, it's a pretty extensive overhaul, really. So they're replacing parts of the housing and roadway deck with precast, like concrete slab on steel. They're putting in like additional like foundation elements. They're installing micropiles and rock bolts, which basically help lock the bridge onto the rock. I guess it would be the bedrock of the area. They're also including isolators, which are going to help flex basically at strategic points to allow the bridge to flex a little bit, but not be subject to like a frequency resonance to create a positive feedback loop. There's a little bit more to it. Maybe we'll come back to this, because actually I think this could be an interesting episode in all of itself, like kind of the design of earthquake resistant buildings and stuff like that.
Mm.
So we might come back to this, cause there's actually still, there's this ongoing project, right? So, even to this day. So there, it's interesting, right? So there's actually basically three phases to this project, the seismic retrofit. So phase one and two already completed. That was basically the phase one and phase two were the retrofits of the approaches to the suspension bridge. So basically the part, and this makes like a lot of sense, right? If you think about it, because the suspension bridge inherently is less rigid, and actually being flexible can help a building survive in an earthquake, because if the building is rigid, the earthquake is just going to like rack it until it breaks. But if it's flexible, it can actually kind of move and sway with the earth. And so that can actually benefit it. And that's why you saw the failure at the more rigid steel arch bridge as opposed to the more flexible suspension part of the bridge from the earthquake in 1989. And so the phase one and phase two have already been completed. Those are the north and south viaducts that approach the bridge. And that's how they've already done that part of it, which is interesting. Yeah, this could be a whole video in and of itself, or a whole podcast episode in and of itself, just talking about the seismic retrofit, which would be interesting. So I think I might come back to that actually. Yeah, so that's Golden Gate Bridge, Derek.
Man, there's a lot going on there.
There's a lot going on there. I mean, we could probably make several episodes about the Golden Gate Bridge. One thing I guess we should mention, there are a few issues with the Golden Gate Bridge. You know, one of which being it is, you know, kind of the most, it's one of the most used suicide sites in the world. Hmm. You know, unfortunately, that is one of the legacies of the Golden Gate Bridge. They are installing suicide nets to prevent people from jumping. And I just wanted to kind of have this opportunity to reach out and say, if you or someone you know are struggling, there is help available. The suicide hotline is 988. If you need to contact somebody, please do that. Losing people is always a tragedy, yes. Especially when that loss is self-inflicted.
And life is precious. You're precious. If no one has told you they love you, we love you. Because like Jim mentioned in one of our earlier episodes, there is a epidemic of loneliness, and I think folks feel that. But seriously, absolutely. Folks, you have value, and times do change, even if it doesn't seem like it will at that moment. So a little little message from your friends that everything's a spring, you know?
Yep,
you're valuable.
Absolutely. We love you. We value you. And if you need help, please reach out to the people who can help you. And again, that hotline is 988.
Know that about the Golden Gate Bridge. Like, that's an interesting, it's important fact to note too, because
it is. It is. Installation of the nets are basically almost complete. So they were completed on the Pacific side in 2022 and due to be complete late 2023. So they're probably about done at this point, because it's almost the end of 2023. But it's important to know. So that'll come. I think that brings us to the end of our episode. Derek, do you got anything to plug for us?
I mean, obviously not sponsored. I just want to thank Porsche for making me realize that you too can have a midlife crisis at 25.
Hell yeah, brother. It is around Christmas. If you would like to purchase a whiskey grail, please wait until the new year.
We're swamped. Help.
We're swamped. Please help us by waiting until January to purchase your whiskey grail, your fine white oak drinking vessel made to mimic a bourbon barrel, and smooth out some of the harsh notes of your whiskey and make the drinking experience that much more enjoyable. Yeah, absolutely.
And so it makes a grail, great Valentine's Day gift grail for the whiskey drinker in your life. So,
absolutely.
Wait until January, foos.
If your man or woman enjoys a good bourbon or a scotch or a rye, the Whiskey Grail is the perfect Valentine's Day gift. And in fact, we usually have a His and Hers Whiskey Grail combo package, give you a little discount and get a special custom engraving on your Whiskey Grails to commemorate your love for each other. So definitely be on the lookout for that from Whiskey Grail in the coming months as we approach Valentine's Day. Also want to shout out us, you know, so, connect with us on our Twitter or on our YouTube feed, leave us a like or a comment, give us a 5-star review if you enjoyed the show today. That helps us out tremendously as we, you know, we're trying to increase our viewership so we can get that sweet, sweet merch drop.
Ooh, yeah, we got to earn the merch drop. It's going to cost money to make it. So we're hoping to have that. I mean, 2024 is a great goal. That would be our first true year. I'm
cool.
Thinking a year one merch drop, but I'm not going to tell you the secret. Well, Jim knows the secret milestone we have to hit, but I believe, unrelated, we just hit our 900th play on Spotify.
Phenomenal.
So, you know, right under 1,000 in less than 3 months. I mean, it's taken off.
I'm excited.
Steady growth. Well, Jim, I know this is probably our longest episode of Everything's a Spring so far.
Absolutely it is.
I know I'll cut it down a bit, but until next time, let's bounce.
Let's bounce. Let's bounce.